The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
For more than a decade, he's been your destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Good morning, Chris. You are a godsend to the listening communities that you serve with that voice of yours.
I turn to you just like I turn to Rush.
I'm a fan of Chris DeGaulle.
And I'm still feeling really quite fine. I think I'm an example, given my age, of what we're all talking about today. I'm vaccinated, I'm doubly boosted, and I believe if that were not the case, I very likely would not be talking to you looking as well as I look, I think, right now.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Okay, I open the radio show. I turn on my microphone. I speak into my microphone from my studio. Fast Eddie is my executive producer. I host a morning show in the morning. Just going over my notes that Eddie's prepared for me here. Glad to have you here today. Did you see that note card that Biden had during his big meeting yesterday? You sit in your chair. You speak, then she speaks. You introduce, then you sit in your... Have you seen the photo of this note card?
Oh, dude, it's... Oh, man.
I have often joked about the film Blazing Saddles. I've often told you that this presidency reminds me so much of what was a comedy theme in the smash hit Blazing Saddles, the greatest comedy, I maintain, ever made in the history of comedies. Mel Brooks as Governor William J. LePetitmane, a totally vapid, empty dunce of a guy who has all the power in the state, and Harvey Korman, who plays the Attorney General of the state, who's this devious, smart, deceptive weasel, who's sort of the evil conspirator in the film, takes advantage of the fact that his boss, the governor, played by Mel Brooks, is a complete dope. And so Harvey Korman, throughout the entire... The plot of Blazing Saddles is actually what we're living right now, but for real and not funny. And that is very devious people wanting to achieve very devious means and using a very stupid old husk to achieve it. This is literally a scene in Blazing Saddles. If you've not seen it, it's literally people telling him when to adjourn a meeting and how to say it. If you've not seen it, I don't know. The visual is always more entertaining. But just if you don't believe me, this is Harvey Korman holding a meeting, although it's the governor's meeting. But Harvey Korman, as the attorney general, is sort of conducting the meeting and guiding it along for the governor, who is transfixed with his buxom secretary. And that's about all. He can't think or concentrate. He doesn't know where he is or what he's doing. Harvey Korman's trying to achieve a means to an end here, and he's got this meeting going on. So he's conducting it, but he can't do it without the governor properly doing all the procedural things. Listen to this. This is it.
As Attorney General, I can assure you that a suitable sheriff will be found to restore the peace in Rock Ridge. Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
Here, play around with this for a while.
Oh, thank you, Eddie.
And then hands him a paddle ball.
It is? Why don't you give these out to some of the boys in lieu of pay? Here you go. Frankie, Johnny, Patsy, Kelly, and one for Miss Stein, my beloved secretary. Play with these boys in lieu of other things. This friggin' thing.
They just start playing paddle ball.
Why do we always get a war?
That's it. That's what we're living, except not funny and real. You sit in your chair. I do. Your chair. My chair. Yes, you sit. I do. No, you. Do you see they're putting in John Kirby a lot more now at the White House podium, too? Pepe Le Pew is starting to really stink up to the joint, to the extent that they've just sent her off to New York now to do The View. So Pepe Le Pew full-time now as a talk show hostess, while John Kirby, who they plucked from the Pentagon, is now at the White House briefing room regularly. I find that kind of interesting. I think that's how bad she sucks. That in due course, we're going to hear an announcement that there's been a bit of a transition in the way the White House communicates. Just a hunch. I don't know. Keep a sharp eye on that. Anyway, wow. The news of the day. The news of the week, maybe the news of the last 20 years, short of this Roe decision that we're expecting eventually, is this ruling yesterday, authored by Justice Clarence Thomas in a 6-3 decision that for the first time in maybe 30 years really definitively affirmed your Second Amendment right. This was a triumph, and the American left is losing its ever-loving mind. Democrats, this from Red State, Democrats lose their minds. DOJ makes concerning statement on SCOTUS gun rights decision. Keith Olbermann, absolutely lunatic. Kathy Hochul, governor of New York, went lunatic. Kamala Cacklebritches went lunatic. Grandpa says he's deeply disappointed. He doesn't know where he is. I call on Americans across the country to make their voices heard on gun safety. Now, of course, the Republicans in the Senate did their part by trying to cramp down on your Second Amendment rights yesterday by passing that egregious gun legislation, which we'll analyze in more detail. I have reason to believe now that based on what the Supreme Court ruled yesterday, what these clowns did in the Senate may well be quickly dispatched with. I mean, considered unconstitutional right away. What is this ruling? I mean, before we get into some of the lunatic responses to it, what is the question at hand in this ruling? The question at hand was pretty straightforward. And that is, can the state of New York require that applicants for gun carry permits, quote, demonstrate a special need for self-protection distinguishable from that of the general community? Can the state of New York require that you must demonstrate a special need for self-protection distinguishable from that of the general community? And you know what Clarence Thomas and the majority of the court said yesterday? They said, you can't do that. You can't put qualifiers on who gets to self-protect. This is why Democrats lost their minds yesterday. That's why the legislature hurried up and passed an affront to the Second Amendment as a response, including some Republicans, I'm sorry to say. We're now talking about the political class generally. That wants your right to bear arms to be a political decision. It needs to be a favor they're doing for you, you see. Politicians grant you. This is what is so dangerous about young people in this country not understanding what natural rights mean. If you don't understand what natural rights are, if you don't understand that these are God-given, said another way, when the founders codified your rights, they said these are gifts given to us by something superior to us. These are rights that we're born with. We exist with as human beings. We're establishing a set of rules that say any government we form cannot infringe at any point in any way on these gifts God gave us. Does everyone understand that? Now, I know most of this audience does. There's a whole generation of people that think the Bill of Rights, the Constitution generally, is just a list of suggestions and gifts that politicians have bestowed on us, gifts that can be monkeyed around with and taken away without really much discussion or procedure. And that's not true. Specifically when it comes to your natural rights, the Bill of Rights, those are gifts that no politician can just take or mollify or play around with or carve out. They're to be protected at all costs from government. And that's why Democrats lost their minds. That's why a lot of Republicans, frankly, lose their minds. Politicians thought they were entitled to usurp your natural right to self-defense. And there are a lot of people in this country who are coming around to the conclusion that that's the way this works. That your right to self-defense is something that a politician on any given election cycle can just decide whether he or she likes it. Not the way it works in this country. It's a fundamental misunderstanding of the firewall known as the Bill of Rights when people screw around with it the way Democrats do, and now, even yesterday, some Republicans. The firewall protects us from the government. Obama always hated this concept, this concept of these rights being a charter of negative liberties. These things spelled out constitutionally, negative liberties, meaning the government can't do anything about what you have as a natural right, as a gift given you. The government can't do anything about it. Does that make sense? I know this isn't terribly high concept to people who actually learn civics, but there's a whole generation, maybe two, who really don't know this. They think all of this stuff is kind of man-created, man-given, man-authored, man-taketh away. No. This is like, for those of you who are spiritual, this would be like a politician saying, I'm now seizing all Bibles and the word of God is now null and void. Not the way it works. Your Second Amendment is exactly the same. They can't do it. There's no cute way around it. There's no nibbling around the edges of it. It's clear. It's easy to understand. It cannot be infringed upon in any way. Your right to self-defense is not something you have to prove to a government. Is everyone very clear about that? Again, I know this audience is, but anybody happening by it that doesn't know that, check yourself and make sure you know down in your heart, in your bones, as an American, what you're entitled to, what your rights are. You've got to know this. This is supremely important because we just had 14 Republicans that think this is negotiable. 15. Pat Toomey is back. The founders did not want future generations to suffer at the hands of tyrants the way they did. Are you familiar with the Third Amendment? If not, here's a bit. No soldier shall in a time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. What does that mean? The founders knew the future wannabe tyrants of our country would want to seize your weapons and your homes in order to control you. They knew. They'd lived this. They've seen it. Do you know how significant and brilliant it is that they could look down the road and see coming what they lived and say, we're going to expressly write this out. There'll be no control over people's firearms to defend themselves. There'll be no control over people's homes. again, as I said yesterday, we're at the top of the power pyramid. The individual is the sovereign in this country, not the government, not a king, not a tyrant. The Supreme Court yesterday just affirmed this was true in a huge way. That seizure of your rights that they were trying in New York, and they're trying in other places, in multiple states now, by the way, these gun laws are going to topple, including in New Jersey, where that government is actively discussing even not allowing 18-year-olds to buy a simple shotgun, for heaven's sakes. The rule of law and due process, our very democracy, is hanging by a thread, and the only thing that saved it yesterday was the Supreme Court. Thank you. This, folks, what happened yesterday is why when people say to me, I'm not voting, I'm not going to vote this far, there's not a dime's worth of difference between... Do you understand that if we had all had the attitude that, oh, the country's lost, screw it, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the parties... Hell with it. Let the Republicans get what's coming to them. I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to participate. Hello, Georgia, first of all. But do you understand that without those three justices that Donald Trump appointed, without a Republican majority to have confirmed them, do you understand how perilously close we are to losing it all? The Supreme Court's it. That's it. They're the only branch left. Still ensuring your rights exist. And that's because, for better or worse, the Republicans, as constituted, confirmed these people and made it happen. Now, I know yesterday 15 of them sold you out. Nothing I can do about that. I know that's frustrating. Only thing we can do now is hopefully vote them out, turn them out, hold them accountable. Some of them are retiring. Hold accountable those that want to replace them. There's a means of getting rid of those people, but these people, these nine people, six of these nine people yesterday, just saved the country. I can't put a finer point on it. And so when people criticize me, you know, Christogal, you're part of the problem. I got an email like that yesterday. You're part of the problem, this idea. You just vote for Republicans no matter what. That's how we get people like Toomey, and that's how we get... Well, maybe. But it's also how we get Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch. And Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Barrett. And without them, and even that loathsome John Roberts yesterday, thank goodness, without them, the Second Amendment's gone. So what choice have we? Not vote? Not support Republicans? Not keep the Senate in Republican hands? As much as I can't stand what Senate Republicans have done, at least some of them, not all of them, and let's be fair, 15 who've decided to shirk their constitutional responsibilities is not the entirety of the party. There's a problem with the party. There has been for a while. That's why Donald Trump. So we continue to chisel away and work hard at gutting the party of these traitors. I don't mind that. Let's keep doing that work. But to say, I'm not participating. Screw it. I'm sitting it out. Yesterday's why you don't sit it out. Yesterday's why we can't afford to sit it out and let John Fetterman become the next senator from Pennsylvania, for instance. Can't happen.
I mean, Chris, that's the difference. I mean, John Fetterman literally pulled a shotgun on a black jogger. I mean, that jogger has a right to defend himself. Am I right? Like that's the difference between the government holding that power and the people not.
Well... What was he, mayor at the time, John Fetterman?
Yep, mayor of Braddock.
Yeah, as the mayor of Braddock, he pulls a gun on a black jogger running by who he thinks was involved in a crime. Mm-hmm. The jogger wasn't involved in a crime. He was just minding his own business. But the mayor drew a gun. Yeah, in a free, sane society, the mayor of Braddock ought to have been shot by that jogger.
Yeah.
Quite frankly. No, and think about that. You know, that's what's interesting. I'm actually glad you said that because this is really, you know, gun control in this country has origins in Jim Crow, in real racism. Keep those blacks away from guns. That's its roots. It's so amazing that Lawrence O'Donnell over at MSNBC, he tweeted, I just responded to this morning, the Supreme Court has denied, or has decided rather, the founders who believed some people should live in slavery also believed we should live in terror. The founders who believed some people should live in slavery also believed we should all live in terror. Now, Charles Cook made a great point. It's a remarkable American moment in history. When once upon a time, it was said, you know, if black people are citizens, they're going to be able to carry guns. And that's not going to be good news for we whites. That was said once upon a time in this country. Horribly. Horrifically. That used to be an opinion amongst many Democrats. If blacks get free and blacks get guns, we're in trouble. 140 years later, and think of the progress this country has made. Yesterday was about more than just affirming your natural rights. Yesterday was a massive symbol of the progress of this great American experiment. 140 years after that, a descendant of slaves wrote the majority opinion on the Supreme Court that said every last one of us, including, yes, you're right, Fast Eddie, that black jogger in Braddock, black men and women have the right to protect themselves, and a black man on the Supreme Court affirmed as much. You have the natural right, and it will not be infringed upon, to defend yourself, and no government can ever infringe upon it. Who has always been opposed to this? Who's always fought this? Democrats. Never forget it. Every time, Democrats. They hated it then, they hate it now. That's why they're shrieking with such hysterics. They know that as long as you have a right to defend yourself, total control can never be theirs. And they hate that. 610-850-0990, the number. 610-850-0990. We're online at 990theanswer.com. Let's take a peek at traffic. When we get back, I don't know if you were able to hear it or not. Andy McCarthy joined me yesterday after the show because this news broke, I don't know, around the lunch hour, a little before the lunch hour yesterday. And Andy gave some brilliant analysis that I wanted you to hear. So you're going to hear that coming up, and we have plenty of it. We got a lot of reaction to this today. Doug Mastriano will be with us today. Pete Hutchinson from the Landmark Legal Foundation with us today. Lots of Pete's.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Join me weekday mornings at 11 on Philadelphia's AM 990 The Answer and 990theanswer.com.
I feel good. I was so damn down and dispirited earlier in the week, folks. A friend reached out and he said, you sound bummed out. He said to me Wednesday. I said, I am bummed out. We had 14 Republicans sell us out in the Senate on the Second Amendment. I'm very dispirited and bummed out. And then Clarence Thomas rode to the rescue yesterday and perked me right up. Huge ruling yesterday. And immediately after it happened, after this show concluded, I hopped on the phone with our friend, former federal prosecutor. He was just on Fox News analyzing it. And I said, can you pop off the TV and give me some quick analysis of what we've just seen? Andrew C. McCarthy, he was good enough to join us. He had some profound stuff to say about this ruling, and I wanted you to hear it.
Chris, always my pleasure.
Let's dive into what this means. First of all, this is the week that we're expecting tons of rulings, and I heard you mention that you were expecting lots more decisions today than what apparently we're going to get. This was a big one, but there's more to come, right?
Yeah, we went into the week with 18, Chris, and on the pace they worked the last few sessions where they issued opinions, they were doing about six at a time. And I thought with the security situation over the last 7 weeks since the draft Alito opinion in the Dobbs case, the abortion case, was leaked, that they'd be very anxious to be done and, you know, get out of Dodge. So my theory was that they'd do six a day, do three opinion days this week, and finish. They only did four today. They did six yesterday, but they did four today, which means math was never my strong suit, but there's a lot more than six left. I know that much.
Yeah, nine left, I think, right?
Yeah, I think that'd be an awful lot to expect them to do tomorrow. I still believe, and now that I've confessed to the audience that I've been wrong on everything, let me make another prediction. But I still think that Dobbs will be last, or it'll at least be in the last batch. Yeah. So I think 9 would be an awful lot to do tomorrow, so I guess we probably go over into next week. But, you know, only they know. We don't know.
Yeah, there's the EPA law stuff, the immigration, remain in Mexico policy stuff.
Yeah,
there's the coach kneeling stuff and the abortion stuff, and that's just some. So anyway, but let's get to the big one today. This specifically deals with New York's gun laws, but it has implications for multiple states that have similar gun laws, yes?
Yeah, I think it has implications, Chris, even for this gas baggery that we see the Senate engaged in at
Thank
the moment.
You.
I think it has
I
federal
wondered.
Implications as well. Well,
I was going to ask you that. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but while you're asking.
Yeah, of course. No, whatever you say.
Well, while you broach it, let's just tuck that in there. Do you think that what this Supreme Court ruling is today, do you think it's wholly separate or related to what the Senate's trying to do?
I think it's related in this sense, Chris. It's not explicitly related. Like, there's nothing in the although the dissents do talk about Uvalde and Buffalo. But I think it's related in this sense. What the left hates, what progressives hate, what the progressives on the court hate, what people in New York hate, at least the government people, is that the Second Amendment is a right in the Constitution that has a meaning that they are not at liberty to change because they think times have changed and it would be reasonable to change it. So I think the Second Amendment is the most willfully misunderstood right in the public discourse of the Constitution. The Second Amendment is not a right to keep and bear arms. The Second Amendment is an acknowledgement that there was a pre-existing natural law right to keep and bear arms at the time the Constitution was adopted. And it is a limitation on government, not a positive right for people. It's a limitation on government saying you cannot restrict the self-defense rights of the American people. They had those rights before there was a United States government. So what progressives have been trying to do, and with great success for a long time, for decades, is change the presumption that, you know, basically you have whatever right the government's willing to give you to keep and bear arms. And the actual meaning of the Second Amendment is that you have a right to keep and bear arms, irrespective of the Constitution and irrespective of the government. And if the weaponry we're talking about, which is weapons that are in common use, not military-grade weapons, but weapons that are in common use, if we're talking about weapons that are in that ambit, the government does not have a right to limit your right to keep and bear them. I mean, it's just, you know, for the common uses like self-defense. And that, you know, progressives don't like that, but it's in the Constitution and it's a right in the Constitution. And it's, you know, they would lay it on the line for things that aren't in the Constitution that they'd like to pretend were rights. But this is a right that's specifically enumerated. And it's really a prohibition on the government. It's not a.
When you hear Biden no, it's valuable. What you just said is so important to understand. When you hear Joe Biden or others say things like, well, for instance, you couldn't own a cannon. And, you know, they always talk about these things. The Second Amendment is not absolute. Actually, this ruling says, yes, it is.
Well, it's absolute where it applies. Well, let me say, I should stop there for a second. No right is absolute. All of our rights. If rights were in a vacuum, Chris, they could be absolute, but all of our rights exist in tension with other rights, right? We have to accommodate them. So even in Heller, where Justice Scalia traced the history of the Second Amendment, he acknowledges that unlike the federal government, the state governments have police power. And as the right to keep and bear arms was always understood at the time that was adopted into the Constitution, the states always had the right to keep weapons out of the hands of felons or to keep weapons out of the hands of the insane, right? So there are restrictions on this. But importantly, this is mainly intended to be a proscription on the federal government.
Yes.
Which is why I bring up the Senate pizzazz that's going on at the moment. The states are always going to have more latitude to regulate because this right always recognized that there was a police power of the states over their internal affairs. But what the court is saying here is that even the states have to respect what the core right is, which is if you don't fall into those recognized categories of exemption, like, you know, felons and the insane, then the public has a right, which pre-exists the Constitution, to keep and bear arms that are in common use. And the government can't take that away.
So then these states that are now, and the Senate rule that's popping up, and these states, you know, I knew New Jersey is just now this week talking about limiting 18 to 21-year-olds from buying even shotguns. That can't possibly be constitutional, can it?
I you know, we've been talking a lot about this idea of kicking it up to 21, and I hear a lot of people say, well, look, you know, we stopped 21-year-olds from 18-year-olds from drinking, right? Well, there's no right to drink in the Constitution. If there was, I'd be out there fighting for it, right? But this is a right that's in the Constitution, and, people say, well, that makes sense. You know, do we want 18-year-olds carrying guns and having guns? And what I would answer is, if an 18-year-old is considered an adult under the law, and we would let the person live by himself, why should he have less of a constitutional right to defend his home and his family than anyone else does? There's no 18-year-old exemption in the Constitution. Now, we know there's some minimal age, right? No one thinks that toddlers should have firearms. I don't think the framers thought so either. But if you're going to let 18-year-olds be adults and live by themselves and have responsibilities, I don't understand why anyone assumes that their fundamental rights can be taken away from them just because the left thinks that guns are icky.
Yeah, I mean, if we can send them to war, you can sure as hell let them buy a shotgun. I don't see how you could make the case otherwise. Really, I don't, just because they're 18. No,
well, yeah, they have a right or they don't, right? I mean, that's what it is.
Andrew C. McCarthy, awesome of you to turn around on such short notice and do this with us. Can you just generally handicap, if you could, what this Senate law is about to do? I assume they'll pass it, maybe vote on it tomorrow.
Here's the thing I'm most worried about, Chris. Is, you know, they're going to do the they're going to do this stuff about the, you know, provide federal funding for red flag laws, which, you know, the states have a right to do. Red flag laws. They have to give you enough due process that it'll hold up. But what you worry about is this is the way the federal government always imposes its will on the states by, you know, making the money so impossible to do without that they comply with whatever conditions Washington prescribes. So I'd be concerned about that. And the other thing I'm concerned about, Chris, is, and this goes along the lines of our whole discussion here about it being a prohibition on the federal government, this law would really insert the government permanently in the background check process. Mm-hmm. What's obviously going to happen here is, you know, now they're going to subject 18 to 21-year-olds to enhanced background checks. And you know what's coming. As soon as that's on the books, the left is going to say, well, why should we just be doing this to 18 to 21-year-olds? Why shouldn't this apply to everyone? So, no. You know, that's how they – that's the two-step that they do. And for that reason, I think this is a healthy reminder that this right is a prohibition on the government. They're not doing you a favor allowing you to keep and bear firearms. You have a right to keep and bear firearms, and the proscription is on them. It's not on you.
Bingo, bingo, bingo. And so bottom line, this ruling affirms that today, and this is a reminder on this law that Biden will inevitably sign and will likely be challenged immediately, I would assume.
Presumably, yes.
Yeah. All right. Do you think these 6-3 rulings, somebody posited to me, Andy, and I'll let you go, these 6-3 rulings so definitively lately and so declaratively, even including Justice Roberts, is this, I bet you're going to say no. I'd like to believe it's true, though. Is this their way of saying, don't screw with us, don't threaten us, we stand in solidarity? Is there any of that going on here or not really? Probably not, I guess.
No, I don't, Chris, I don't think so, because if you look at the cases, we've had a real flurry of cases since around last Monday. I mean, we've probably had I'm not doing the math again, I'll get it wrong. But there's been some very interesting divisions of the court. But I do think, like, overarchingly, you have a 6-3 preponderant conservative majority on the court, which I consider to be a constitutional majority on the court. And what the dynamic has changed is when it was a 5-4 court, Chief Justice Roberts had a lot more ability by acting as the swing vote to deflect what cases the court would take and what issues it would decide even in those cases. In a 6-3 court, the dynamic does not allow him to have that kind of control anymore. And I think that's why the reason you're seeing these big decisions come down is the court has to take 4 justices to take a case. And usually you won't vote to take a case unless you think you have 5 to win, right? Otherwise you vote against taking it. So now I think they're more inclined to take cases, and Chief Justice Roberts can't persuade the conservatives that if they take a case he'd rather see them not take, he might vote with the left to thwart them. Huh. You know, now they have 5 to win anyway.
Any shot that Roberts ultimately comes down on the side of the rest of the majority on the Mississippi abortion case? Any shot he changes his mind from that draft opinion?
I sure hope so. I mean, he's in the majority today. This was a hot-button case. He's in the majority. This is an issue that he's been, I think, very consistent on over the years. I think there are reasons to be concerned about him in connection with the abortion case because he usually relies on stare decisis, the principle that the court should follow its prior precedents, presumptively. He often relies on that for the purpose of deflecting cases that he'd rather see the court not take. But they've taken this one. And, you know, it's do or die now. You have to decide. And I think it really would be weak to say, I think Roe should be upheld, even though it's a constitutional atrocity, because it's been on the books for so long. You know, Plessy versus Ferguson was on the books for a long time, too.
He's the go-to for Fox News, and he was good enough to step away literally moments ago from TV to give us this analysis on this breaking news, a flurry of court activity, and Andrew C. McCarthy is our go-to authority. Thank you, my friend, for being a resource, as always.
Thanks, Chris. Great to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
So that was my conversation with Andrew C. McCarthy yesterday. No, we didn't hit our heads. We were actually speaking yesterday. Just wanted you to know that. Coming up, we will talk with Pete Hutchinson, the president of the Landmark Legal Foundation, on this ruling as well and what he anticipates just around the bend. And I'd love your reaction, too. You know, Phil Murphy, Kathy Hochul in New York, they're all out there screaming and yelling and promising they're going to continue to hard charge at the Second Amendment. Your reaction to this today? 610-850-0990 if you have it. 610-850-0990. Pete Hegseth of Fox News, Fox and Friends Weekend. He's got a brand new important book called Battle for the American Mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation. We'll talk to him about another huge Supreme Court ruling that happened this week. I don't know how you don't love Marjorie Taylor Greene. Sometimes Marjorie Taylor Greene is just all of us, isn't she? Some British reporter yesterday, they were holding a press conference on Capitol Hill, and said, "Hello, I'm Mary Poppins." And said, "Representative Greene, we don't have this sort of violence." What the key to this whole thing and this whole exchange is what you hear her kind of say off mic at the end. Listen closely.
Yeah, I understand that we don't have guns in the UK. That is true, but we don't have mass shootings either. Children aren't scared to go to
you
school.
You have mass stabbings, lady. You have all kinds of murder,
nothing
and you've
like
got laws
same,
against
nothing
that.
Like the same rates.
Well,
here.
You can go back to your country and worry about your no guns.
That's very kind.
We
of
like
that.
Ours here.
You have mass stabbings, lady. She sounds like Flo from Mel's Diner in Alice. Kiss my grits. You have mass stabbings, lady. Go back to your country. Just perfect. You know, sometimes you just have to say that. I know it's not the most sophisticated, decorous way to say it, but sometimes it's just that simple. Shut up. Shut up, pack up, and get the hell out. I'm not going to be lectured to you by you from across the pond about our gun laws compared to yours and... We're doing just fine here, thanks a lot. We like our guns, lady. You have mass stabbings. Get out of here. Alito, in his dissent yesterday, totally dunking on Breyer. Or not his dissent, his concurring opinion. Dunking on Breyer's dissent. Hilarious. In light of what we have actually held, it's hard to see what legitimate purpose can possibly be served by most of the dissent's lengthy introduction section. Breyer basically wrote yesterday, I can't believe in light of Buffalo and Uvalde, we're passing this. I can't believe. And Alito's like, I have no idea why you're wasting our time with that. That's not what we're here to discuss. Why are you doing current event news? We're Supreme Court justices. Dope. That's my Marjorie Taylor Greene shorthand for very smart justice speak. Alito writes, why, for example, does the dissent think it's relevant to recount the mass shootings that have occurred in recent years? Does the dissent think that laws like New York's prevent or deter such atrocities? Will a person bent on carrying out a mass shooting be stopped if he knows that it's illegal to carry a handgun outside the home? And how does the dissent account for the fact that one of the mass shootings near the top of its list took place in Buffalo? The New York law at issue in this case obviously didn't stop him. What's the relevance of statistics about the use of guns to commit suicide? Does the dissent think that a lot of people who possess guns in their homes will be stopped or deterred from shooting themselves if they can't lawfully carry guns outside the home? Very snarky. Justice Alito and Marjorie Taylor Greene.
This
I love
is
it.
WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Hey, your show is awesome.
Hi, good morning. Love you, love your staff. Thank you so much. God bless y'all.
Love you and Fans Daddy and the show.
You guys are doing a fantastic job. Thank you very much, Chris.
Most AR-15 owners are former military, okay. 35-plus.
Let me say one more. So that's all I'm saying, okay. Is that they're not
once,
crazy
once,
people.
Okay. Here's the thing. Once black people get guns in this country, the gun laws will change. Trust me.
This is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
You know Pete Hegseth well, Fox and Friends. He was just on Fox. You're almost on every day somewhere, Pete. If it's not on Fox and Friends, you're on one of the Fox shows almost every day. And why shouldn't he be? He's got a brand new book called Battle for the American Mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation. Pete, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
And I congratulate you, and I mean this earnestly. You seem to be a real fan favorite. I have watched your work, and I've kind of watched you over the years. People really love what you do and what you stand for. You have a passion, particularly for the field of education, it seems.
Well, I appreciate that. I think I do. I'm so grateful for the platform. Fox is an amazing place to be able to talk about the things that really matter, what people are really feeling. And I think, you know, in the book, we talk about the COVID-19 moment, which is what we call it, when the classroom came into our homes because of COVID and people almost immediately were exposed to what had been hidden from them in the classroom. And what felt like an academic problem or something that was far away was suddenly confronting all of us, and that includes me. So in many ways, I'm learning along with the audience and exploring it too. And, you know, Fox is the biggest rated network for a reason, because we have an amazing audience, and I think they're dialed into the erosion of the same things we see. Faith has been stripped out of the public square, not to mention the public classroom. Families are under assault. Basics like gender, you're defining you by your race are now what the left wants everything defined by. And it brings these issues which were felt political and cultural and somewhere else into everybody's lives. And so I'm a dad, you know, I've got a bunch of kids, and I worry about the world they're going into, the country they're inheriting. And it's on us to do something about it, to give them a fighting chance. So the book Battle for the American Mind is a gift to them, and hopefully to everyone else's kids and grandkids, to say, here's what we can do. Here's what you can do right now if you want to affect the sphere around you, which also obviously has impacts on our country and our culture.
If you don't mind me being personal, and it's none of my business, I'm just curious because you mentioned that you have kids. I'll share with you my situation first, just to prove to you that I'm being honest broker when I ask you this question. I have three kids, and we pulled our youngest daughter out of public education and put her into a private Christian school in the last year. If we had it to do all over again, Pete, we would have put all three of our kids in a Christian education. My two sons are about to finish out high school, so we're going to kind of let them ride it out. But if I had it to do all over again, I'd do it differently just because of the kind of the degradation of the public school system. I was curious about your kids' own upbringing and their educations. If you've had a change.
I had the same learning experience. I mean, I was a public school kid. My dad was a public school teacher. I assumed they would all go to public school. That was, if good enough for me, good enough for them.
Right.
That was the mindset for sure. Yes, I just next school year will finally have all my kids, all seven of them, in classical Christian school.
Wow.
Two years ago, they were in public school, and then we moved them to a Catholic school, and even that, in my mind,
yes,
was not giving them the best of the best. And it's just, to me, it's the kind of fact we're even moving. We're moving to a school, so in order to do that. It feels like a ticking clock.
Yes.
Like every moment they're not in a classroom that reinforces the things that we care about, I feel like I'm losing time. And so, listen, it's mostly on the home and the church and the parents to fortify, and that's what you're doing. But at the end of the day, why wouldn't I want a school that reinforces that as well? So it's been a journey and a learning experience, but we're finally to a point where, and they're all young, thank goodness, so they'll go through it, but you know, we'll have a sixth grader who's going into classical Christian for the first year, so he'll have a number of years, but it does feel like a little bit of catch-up, and the options are out there now, thank God.
And I will say, Pete Hegseth's book, by the way, is Battle for the American Mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation. I'm battling real resentment because, like you, as a product of public education, and my parents, my mother and wife were both public educators, too, it breaks my heart. It makes me angry because it really, you know, yeah, my daughter is a seventh grader. She's willing. She's ready. She's doing it. She's enjoying it. But it's been a transition, and I kind of resent it. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I resent that we have to do this.
Oh, my goodness. You're exactly right. In fact, the biggest feedback I've gotten on the book is from teachers saying, thank you for writing this, and it's spot on. But second of all, how angry they are at the fact that this entire huge part of our society has been co-opted right underneath our noses. This is not an issue of our teachers good.
That's right.
This is about the pipelines that are forcing teachers in a certain direction, and you can't live your values in the classroom unless you are part of the left-wing educational industrial complex. And as a result, here's the scary part. The whole idea that you can move to a zip code or a conservative community and that'll be reflected in your local public school is gone.
Yes.
The pipeline of what feeds that school, the unions, the accreditation, the teachers' colleges, it all comes from the same places. So, yes, you may have a great conservative community, but the teachers in that school had to go through a certain program which molds them in a certain direction. Now most of the curriculum is mostly federalized at this point anyway, that they've entirely co-opted this treasure that was our public school system. And for patriots and Christians looking for an alternative, it's just not an option. It shouldn't be an option. And the problem is we pay property taxes.
Yep.
We work hard. And, you know, two jobs, how do you afford it? It's a real challenge. I mean, school choice is a part of it, but we also have to build our own schools.
Hey, and that's why that Supreme Court, I mean, Pete, you know better than anybody, that's why the Supreme Court ruling this week is so huge, yes?
Huge. I mean, by the way, that is only the latest in a long line of attempts by the government and the left to block any other schooling other than public school. I mean, they almost banned homeschooling.
Yes.
I believe it was in the 80s. They tried to ban it federally. They tried to ban Christian education in Oregon back in the early 20th century. And this was an attempt to block parents' ability to decide where their kids go because they don't live close enough to a public school in a rural area. Huge win from the Supreme Court. And parents need to take advantage of the latitude they've gained because of a good ruling.
The book is called Battle for the American Mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation. Pete, what have you learned about, here's something that's just kind of shocked my conscience over the last couple of years, and that's the role of the school board, or the inactivity in some cases. I find they kind of fall into one of two camps, sort of a subversive element that's very, very knowledgeable to the detriment of the culture and the community and the kids and the school and the teachers, and then the other who's sort of I don't know, maybe well-intentioned, but too busy to pay attention and just sort of rubber stamps whatever the radicals want. That's kind of what I've seen our school boards made up of.
I think that's fair. I mean, most of our school boards, if we're being honest, have been co-opted by the teachers' unions.
Yes.
They're effectively arms of the unions. They're low-profile races. Most people aren't paying attention. And so as a result, radicals or hand-picked school board members end up winning. Thankfully, there's been a change in that. you were seeing, conservatives and patriots run for school boards and win once they know what's at stake. But and I say this in the book, and I mean it kindly, because I love what people are doing standing up at their school boards. But I call that, it's kind of like charging a fortified machine gun nest with Nerf guns.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we salute your efforts, but you're probably going to die, because the institutions are so big and strong and powerful that they squelch dissent. So if you're going to run for school board, you better put on the armor of God and go in there being ready to fight, because otherwise nothing's going to change.
And what you said is, we've been hammering this home too, don't assume that just because your child is enrolled in a Christian school, a Catholic school, a private school, don't assume the radical stuff can't permeate those places too.
Oh my goodness, it's worse in some of those places.
Yeah.
Especially some of the more elite schools. And I would say this, I say this kindly as well, sort of casually, Christian schools, like, we sprinkle a little God on top.
Yeah.
The progressive prerogatives, I mean, this is where the story of the takeover is so important in the book Battle for the American Mind. Even if you're in a private school that is Christian, the curriculum is progressive. The progressives rewrote the curriculum 100 years ago, and the structure of school. So the bell ringing, that's a progressive thing. The social studies, seven periods in the day, even the Pledge of Allegiance was created by a socialist. It didn't say under God originally. It was meant to form allegiance to the state and pull kids away from God. So it's a twisted story when you read it all, but it helps you understand how they've captured it. So when you're taking social studies with your new prerogatives, you're taking a progressive view of education that is not how our founders were ever educated, steeped in Greek and Latin and history great books. That's all been stripped out, and that's what we're trying to rediscover.
Final question, Pete Hegseth. The book Battle for the American Mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation. I am not bullish on public education at all. In fact, with this Supreme Court ruling, I kind of wonder if in the next 10 years we're not going to see a wholesale, with the report of massive teachers migrating out of public education, leaving early, retiring, quitting. Couple that with students and parents that are moving on to other private forms of education. I don't know that this is sustainable, is it?
I don't think it is, and I hope it's not. Frankly, that's what we argue for in the book, is that I think parents should retreat from the public schools, find alternatives for their kids, start alternatives. We should fight for universal educational tax credits so the dollars follow the parents. And once public schools feel under threat, they'll be, you would hope, based on market competition, they'll be forced to respond to the consumer and create a product that actually delivers. Because I don't want to leave kids behind in failing schools.
No.
In inner cities or rural areas where there aren't many or any options. They need to get better as well. So I think the system has to collapse in order to change, because going along with the status quo is not going to get it done.
You did a Fox Nation special as well, did you not? Not too long ago on this subject.
It's called The Miseducation of America on Fox Nation. It's now a 6-episode series. Helps further unravel and visualize what's happening in elementary schools, in middle schools, in public schools and private schools. Yeah.
I hope people will watch it. It's so important. Pete, thank you for lending your voice and calling attention to it on such a big platform. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it.
This is Sebastian Gorka. Join me this afternoon at 3 on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. Now with Philadelphia's Morning Answer, here's Chris DeGaulle.
Pete Hutchinson just around the corner, president of the Landmark Legal Foundation. He'll give us his read on the Supreme Court opinions thus far and what we expect to come. I'll also have to ask him about this extremely important piece from Molly Hemingway. It's a lengthy read. I recommend it. I'm not going to be able to get through all of it here. At the Federalist, yes, Biden is hiding his plan to rig the 2022 midterm elections. Now, Molly is a very serious person. Molly is not anyone that you would consider wing nut. You know, she's not. You can't dismiss Molly Hemingway as Mike Lindell, for instance, right? Molly's a very sober, critical thinker. She's very serious. Mainstream media still puts her on TV, so she's considered legit. And I, folks, don't get mad at me for saying that about Mike. I'm saying that lovingly, jokingly. Everyone dismisses Mike as a kook on the left, but Molly is not somebody that's dismissed as a kook. She and her husband, Mark, are very, very thoughtful journalists of a long time and long tenured standing in Washington. So here's what she writes. President Biden really does not want the public to know about his federal takeover of the election. Dozens of members of Congress have repeatedly asked for details to no avail. Good government groups, members of the media, private citizens have filed requests under the Freedom of Information Act. Not one single one of them has been responded to. All signs indicate a concerted effort to keep the public in the dark until at least after the November midterm elections. The lack of transparency and responsiveness is so bad, the Department of Justice and some of its agencies have been repeatedly sued for the information. When President Biden ordered all 600 federal agencies to expand citizens' opportunities to register to vote and to obtain information about and participate in the electoral process back on March of 2021, Republican politicians, constitutional scholars, and election integrity specialists began to worry exactly what was up his sleeve. And they had good reason. The 2020 election, writes Molly, had suffered from widespread and coordinated efforts by Democrat activists and donors to run get-out-the-vote operations from inside state and local government election offices, predominantly in Democrat-leaning areas of swing states. Hello, Philadelphia. Hello, satellite election centers. Hello, Zuckerbucks. Independent researchers have shown that the effect of this takeover of government election offices was extremely partisan and favored Democrats overwhelmingly. At the time the order was issued, Democrats were also hoping to pass H.R. 1, a continuation of the effort to destabilize elections throughout the country via a federalized takeover of state election administrations. Again, this was the importance of the United States Senate not falling into Democrat hands. This is why they want to eliminate the filibuster. They wanted to take over and federalize the elections. If Democrats had gotten their way and eliminated the filibuster, they would have gone with a simple majority vote and they would have passed federal legislation to take over and run all state elections. Biden gave each federal agency 200 days to file their plans for approval by none other than, ah, yes, the woman really running the show, Susan Rice, his hyperpartisan domestic policy advisor. Yet fully 9 months after those plans were due, they are all being hidden from public, even as evidence is emerging that the election operation is in full swing. There are several major problems with Biden's secret plan, critics say. It's unethical to tie federal benefits to election activity. It's unconstitutional to have the federal government take authority that belongs to the states and which Congress has not granted. And given that all 50 states have different laws and processes governing election administration, it's a recipe for chaos, for confusion, and fraud at a time election security concerns are particularly fraught. Mobilizing voters. Now, listen to this. Again, this is Molly Hemingway at The Federalist, and I'm reading from a lengthy piece called Yes, Biden is Hiding His Plan to Rig the 2022 Midterm Elections. Mobilizing voters is always a political act. Choosing which groups to target for get-out-the-vote efforts is one of the most important activities done by political campaigns. Federal agencies that interact with the public by doling out benefits can easily pressure recipients to vote for particular candidates and positions. Congress passed the Hatch Act in 1939 that bans bureaucrats and bureaucracies from being involved in election activities after Democrats used Works Progress Administration programs and personnel for partisan political advantage. And she goes on to detail the history of this. Conservatives may be in the dark, but left-wing activist groups are fully involved in this plot. The left-wing dark money group Demos put out press releases immediately after this executive order was issued saying it would be happy to work with the federal agencies on the project. And then the group admitted publicly that they organized agency-based working groups and met with staff in these agencies to provide technical expertise as they developed their initial voter registration plans to ensure those plans reflect the knowledge and priorities of the various agency stakeholders. It also admits they developed research and resources to assist and advance agency efforts to implement robust voter registration opportunities, including a slide deck explainer of the agency's potential for impact, best practices for conducting voter registration at federal agencies, and recommendations for modernizing and improving the accessibility of vote.gov. No one's been able to see any of this. President Biden ordered 600, I say again, federal agencies to expand citizens' opportunities to register to vote back on March 7th of 2021, and nobody has been able to see the results of what this order has brought. This might be a good segue to our friend Pete Hutchinson. He's the president of Landmark Legal Foundation. I want to get into some of the Supreme Court rulings in just a little bit, Pete, but I know this isn't why we brought you here, but Molly Hemingway has written this very important, as I say, 8-page analysis of the Biden administration's plans for the midterm elections and beyond. This notion of a massive voter registration push using government agencies and government funds, it's, and no one's been able to see it, Pete. They haven't... The meddling that went on in 2020 continues in 2022. It worked with great effect, and it seems that they don't intend to stop. Welcome in.
Well, thanks for having me on, Chris. And I haven't read her piece yet, but as you were talking about it, it reminds me of the coordination between the Justice Department, the president, and the National School Boards Association in constructing their sicking of federal counterterrorism agents on school parents who show up at school board meetings. We've asked for records related to that relationship and to, you know, how that came about and how it's being implemented. And we've been stonewalled by the Justice Department. So I'm not surprised that nobody's been able to see anything about it. And we're going to end up in a lawsuit that we're going to file here probably in the next few weeks to try to get the records. And that's exactly what's going to happen. And they'll drag it out until the election's over and no one will know that, how it worked. But it's if you control the process, you can really control the outcome. And that's what it sounds like they're doing here. That's very concerning.
Is the DOJ the most frightening entity in the United States government at this hour? They strike me as getting increasingly more subversive and aggressive and abusive with every passing day, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. Am I wrong? Am I getting into my own head about this?
Well, it certainly seems that federal law enforcement broadly is being politicized to a higher and higher degree every week, and you got to believe that the frontline agents and the attorneys, by and large, in the Justice Department are not political, but the ones that are the ones in the most powerful places and who can do the most damage, storming into this former Justice Department official's home with a search warrant, leaving him out in his pajamas on the street to humiliate him. That's the kind of intimidation tactics that I think you're talking about, and that's just not how that is supposed to work in the United States of America. That's how it works in countries that we do not respect, and it's critical that this be brought under control, but it's just not going to happen until there's different leadership.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair and honest, it didn't feel like either. I don't know if it's just so big and daunting a prospect that, one administration, one term of one administration can correct it. Maybe Trump, for the first 2 years, didn't even really have a good hand on what was going on around him. Maybe trusted institutionalists too much. I don't know. It was clear that another term of Donald Trump was a real threat to this existence. That's clear. I wonder, I sometimes will allow myself to daydream What of another 4 years of Trump? And would he have been able to gut this a little bit? Maybe was that what they were so freaked out about? I don't know. Maybe. But it seems like they're hell-bent on restoring it and juicing it on steroids to make sure it's never threatened again. That's what it feels like.
You know, the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department is being run by some just extreme left-wing, radical, progressive. And that's the department that can really do damage. And that's where election, you know, election-related activities emanate from there. I'm not surprised that that would be the most aggressive. But that certainly would not have happened in a second term of President Trump or any conservative, any Republican, because the rule of law is so much more and promoted from that the conservative viewpoint. So, yeah, you know, Chris, it's dangerous for you to be daydreaming. I just, you got to stay down here on Earth.
Pete Hutchison, I will say this. I'll pivot to something a little more positive and optimistic, at least for now. And this is what I say to people that are always so down on voting Republican, and I'm just not going to vote, and screw them, and there's not a dime's worth of difference. I always like to remind people that if you take that attitude, as much as I am sick, just sick to my stomach, that 15 Republicans on the same day, we have this monumental ruling from the Supreme Court, they pass an infringement on the Second Amendment, as far as I'm concerned. Nevertheless, it can't be understated, the significance of this Supreme Court, because if it weren't for the judicial branch of government at this hour, I really do feel like I'd kind of lose my will to continue talking about this country in any positive or optimistic way. The judicial branch seems to be what's about to save us at the moment. Is that an overstatement?
Well, I don't think so. Congress won't do its job. They throw all the responsibilities over to federal agencies and for carrying out federal laws or implementing them. The executive branch is gone, as far as I'm concerned, at least for this moment. And that is why you see such a coordinated and concentrated effort to undermine the credibility and the legitimacy of the judiciary. You know,
literal threats. And if I may, I'm just going to throw in, to your point, I have in front of me audio today. The number of times, and I just, because I transcribe a lot of these clips that we play, so many leftists use the word that you just did, legitimacy. They talk about, like, Lori Lightfoot. We don't need the whole thing, Ed, but just give me some of Lori Lightfoot from yesterday. For instance, the mayor of Chicago on this Supreme Court ruling, to your point. Listen to this, Pete.
We're part of an amicus effort on the behalf of a number of states in support of the New York law and really focusing on the importance of federalism. But unfortunately, given the composition of this court, we're not surprised that they struck down the New York law. But I think that they gave ample opportunity for New York and other states to pass other laws. They're going to make common sense restrictions on gun use, and particularly people displaying weapons in public, which is itself a threat. And I think Mayor Adams is absolutely right. It is going to make it more challenging for police officers all across New York State to be able to do their job. It doesn't have any immediate consequences for us here in Chicago. Right. And it's interesting that it's coming, obviously, on the heels of the bipartisan effort in the Senate.
I was going to ask you, Mary Lightfoot, about any impact on Chicago, or if you would need to do anything or feel like you would need to do anything moving forward here, given that Illinois is not one of the handful of states that has a similar law to New York. How do you see the broader political implications?
Look, I just think it sends the wrong message in light of the fact that we hopefully are on the cusp of the Senate taking final action on a bipartisan set of gun reforms that we've all been lobbying for and frankly has overwhelming support in the American public. The fact that the court is coming down with this decision feels tone deaf. And I worry that it undermines the legitimacy of the court.
There it is.
Particularly given the
fact that the court is coming down with this decision feels tone deaf. I worry that it undermines the legitimacy of the court. Yeah. And this was a press question, too, to Pepe Le Pew, the press secretary. A reporter said, will the president accept the Roe versus Wade ruling as legitimate? Who the hell is anyone to say the Supreme Court is or isn't legitimate? And as though rulings on the Constitution have a tone, or that there's such a thing as tone. It's just an interesting turn of phrase, right. Pete Hutchison.
I'm sure the Supreme Court justices are concerned about the messages they're sending. The message that was sent yesterday is that the United States Constitution has an amendment that specifically states that individuals have a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. And yesterday's decision, all it said was, it says bear arms too, which means you can carry them outside your home. The decision and the concurrences go to great lengths to say, you know, we're not saying that everybody can carry a concealed bazooka down the street. What we're saying is this is a constitutional right enumerated in the Constitution. You know, the left is so great about promoting constitutional rights that are essentially made up. You've got a right to pornography. You've got a right to
abortion,
you know, gay marriage or to abortion or you name it. These are nowhere to be found in the Constitution. The one right that's in the Constitution right there for everybody to see. No, we can't have that. Guns are bad. We've got to get rid of them. And
can
Lori
we talk,
Lightfoot, I mean,
yeah.
Good
May
heaven.
I ask you,
Mayor
Pete?
Of Chicago, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, sorry, I just got to ask you, when you brought up, you know, guns are bad, which is ultimately their theme, the left loves to talk about muskets. They love to talk about militias. You also said they went to great lengths to talk about bazookas. There's this idea that no reasonable discussion about guns can happen or will be allowed. That and there are people. I mean, by the way, I have heard from people that believe if you want a nuke in your living room, then so be it. If you want a cannon in your living room, then so be it. That there is no way you can have any kind of restriction on the Second Amendment at all. I don't think that's accurate to say or reasonable to say there's nothing to discuss when it comes to weaponry in the United States. I'm not cheering it, don't misunderstand, but the Supreme Court's been clear on this, have they not?
Very clear.
Can you explain it a bit?
Keep and bear arms. Well, it's, as I was saying, the Constitution says you've got a right to keep and bear arms. And in the Heller case, 10 years ago or so, the Supreme Court determined that that is an individual right. It's not the right of a militia. It's not the right of a, you know, community. It is a individual right. And in yesterday's case, the individual right was concluded that you have an individual right to bear arms outside of your home, and states like New York that make it virtually impossible to bear arms outside your home legally, that goes too far. That is, you know, that was the end of the discussion, as far as I'm concerned, from the holding standpoint. But you know, I was just like Lori Lightfoot talking about how this is going to make police, you know, the job of police harder. If you live in Chicago, like my daughter does, you are afraid to walk down the street, even in, you know, fairly nice areas of the city, because there's no law enforcement. They're so understaffed, and there are criminals running rampant. Those are the people, the vulnerable people, particularly of color in Chicago. Those are the people who need to keep and bear firearms for their safety. They're scared to death, and they ought to be. And Lori Lightfoot doesn't want them to be protected. She won't defend her police department. She won't encourage people to support law enforcement, to support their neighbors. She, you know, that attitude just cracks me up. By the way, she used the word federalism in that cut, which cracked me up. I hope I wasn't overheard laughing.
Oh,
but
yes.
Give me a break. Those are the people you got to read Alito's concurrence in the gun decision. It is beautiful.
It's hilarious. It's kind of snarky, which I dug. We did read a little of it earlier. Chicago's richest man, while we're talking about Chicago, this is a headline yesterday from the Examiner. Chicago's richest man moves $22 billion company to Florida, citing crime. Yeah. Ken Griffin, hedge fund billionaire worth $29 billion, announced he has moved from Democrat-led Illinois to Republican-led Florida. While not stated in a letter to employees, Citadel officials reportedly said crime was a critical factor in the decision to move. If people aren't safe here, they're not going to live here, he said in an interview recently. I've had multiple colleagues mugged at gunpoint. I've had a colleague stabbed on the way to work. Countless issues of burglary. I mean, that's a real difficult backdrop with which to draw talent to your city.
Oh, man.
So he's on his way to Florida, for heaven's sakes.
Well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah. That,
you know, there's such a... People are flooding out of blue states and cities like Chicago and New York and California. They're going to Texas and they're going to Florida. They're going to Tennessee. Those are states that are that support law enforcement, that do not have state taxes. You know, there's just so many advantages to go into those states. And I don't know. Chicago weather is, you know, awesome for a lot of people, but oh, man.
Pete,
Florida is just the place to be, although I like it here in Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah, well, that's free people in flyover country, as they derisively call it in the media circles, but it's still where free people live. Pete, before I let you go, I know there's some rulings to come, and we'll have you back when they roll out. But what the Senate did yesterday and what the president is likely to sign, do you think – that given this ruling, do you think it's an affront to that ruling, or are they wholly separate? I mean, could you use yesterday's ruling against, for instance, this incentive to states for red flag laws or extra scrutiny for 18 to 21-year-olds? Is that an infringement, and do you think this ruling yesterday could apply?
Well, it's just really going to boil down to what the details are. Justice Kavanaugh, in his concurrence, which was joined by Chief Justice Roberts, noted that there are many, so long as the law is written in a way that a permit, just for example, for whatever reason, is or a restriction applies objectively and broadly, you know, objectively to the targeted, you know, the issue, then it probably would survive. And I have to be honest, I have not followed this legislation. I've been focused on the Supreme Court.
Sure.
So I don't really know. But I suspect to get that many Republicans on board that it's much less of a scary proposition than otherwise it might be. So long as there's an objective criterion, it's not some bureaucrat sitting in a room somewhere that doesn't want anybody to have a gun, it'll have a better chance. But it'll be litigated. We'll find out.
Pete Hutchinson, president of Landmark Legal Foundation. Pete, thanks for your time today. We will certainly have you back as more of these rulings unfold, I guess, today. And maybe – Andy McCarthy was not of the opinion they're going to roll out 9 more decisions today. So it's probably going to go into next week.
There'll be at least 2 days. They may even, you know, drop Dobbs next Friday as they helicopter off the roof and go to Europe.
So sad. Probably. In fact, there's some debate as to whether they're even in the building, right? There's some talk that they may not even be there.
Yeah, I'd be stunned if they are, frankly.
That's sad. Pete, thank you, my friend. Have a great weekend.
Okay. Chris, take care. Bye-bye.
Telephone number, 610-850-0990, 610-850-0990. Do you know, yesterday was a celebration of 50 years of Title IX? And, of course, the Biden administration is monkeying around with Title IX, too, like they monkey around with everything. It's kind of I think it's hilarious, actually, for the American left to celebrate Title IX. Given what they're doing to women in competitive sports. We're going to get into that coming up with Angela Morabito. Domo Oragato.
Let's do it.
I'm very very serious about this question. You ready? It goes like this. Little Eddie is there in his playpen. You have to give him one of these two items. Ugh. You have to give him an e-cigarette or you have to give him the COVID shot. Which one do you give him?
Right now, if I have to do one, then it would probably be the e-cigarette. I worry about his little heart. Young boys, you know, myocarditis. Yeah, that just... And a one-off.
That's exactly what I said. I said, if you asked me, if you held a gun to my head and said, which thing would you rather your kids ingest? The COVID shot or an e-cigarette? Which one would you rather? I absolutely said the same thing. I think the potential for damage to your system as a child sucking on an e-cigarette is less than the potential damage from that shot, given the research that I'm reading.
It's a one-off. This is a one-off, people.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration officially ordered yesterday, we talked about this, and then they made it official after the show, Juul Labs, Inc. Stop selling its vape devices and cartridges, saying that there is insufficient evidence to assess the potential toxicological risks of using the product. Today's action is further progress on the FDA's commitment to ensuring that all e-cigarettes and electronic nicotine delivery system products currently being marketed to consumers meet our public health standards. The agency has dedicated significant resources to review products from companies that account for most of the U.S. market. We recognize that these make up a significant part of the available products and may have played a disproportionate role in the rise of youth vaping. The FDA acknowledged it has not received clinical information to suggest an immediate hazard associated with the use of Juul's devices or pods, but said the agency issued its marketing denial orders against the company because there is insufficient evidence to assess the potential toxicological risks of using the products. Did you follow this? Now, again, folks, I'm a cigar guy. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. I don't know anything about vaping. But this is really sort of an amazing acknowledgement. We don't have any data to suggest it's a hazard. There's insufficient evidence to assess the potential toxicological risks. Nevertheless, we're taking it off the market. Now, I ask you again, they just greenlit injecting your child, your baby, your toddler with the COVID shot. Would you say that there is conclusive evidence, 100% slam dunk assurance that there is no hazard associated with the shot? Would you say there is sufficient evidence to assess there is no risk from the shot?
No,
that's right. So my point is, if you're going to pull Juul e-cigarettes off the market without having conclusive proof of whether or not they're damaging, why would you not use the very same rationale for the shot? And the answer is very simple. The Juul company does not have the walking around cash that Pfizer does. If Juul had the kind of money Pfizer had, Juul wouldn't be out of business today. The FDA, in its press release, directed smokers who want to quit to consider using other e-cigarette products the agency has authorized for use, such as R.J. Reynolds' Vuse product. That's interesting. R.J. Reynolds. So the government officially endorsed a tobacco company. Hey, listen. You know, if I didn't know any better, I'd say this might be personal and targeted at Juul itself. I wonder who runs Juul. I wonder who owns it. I haven't looked it up. It kind of crossed my mind yesterday. It wouldn't surprise me if Juul is run by or owned by some Republican. Home Depot kind of guy. The guy that originally founded Home Depot, that Republican guy. I'll bet you there's something. There's a story here, and I don't know what it is. But it's not just as simple as the FDA is very concerned about Juul. There's something very specific about this company that the Biden administration has decided they want to take out. Now, were I also to guess, I suspect vaping has been a real thorn in the side of the tobacco industry. And the tobacco industry probably came along with other products. And this is probably the government's way of helping the tobacco, big tobacco, get back in the game.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990. The Answer, a Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. For more than a decade, he's been Philadelphia's destination for news, opinion, and passion.
Your common sense is really keeping me sane. Thank you.
I start in the morning with Chris, and then I go all the way through the day until I get out of my car when I come home.
Good morning, man. Love your show.
We remember what it used to be like before Title IX. And just how much it's changed. She said, gosh, they don't teach that in school. We never heard of that. And it's so important that we do not forget.
With this is Philadelphia's Morning Answer with Chris DeGaulle on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer, and 990theanswer.com.
Great to be with you today. Happy Friday. Coming up in just about a half an hour, the Senate, gubernatorial candidate. We're running a couple of races here simultaneously in Pennsylvania. Doug Mastriano, who's running for governor in Pennsylvania, versus Josh Shapiro. I've already gotten calls from people today asking us, you got to tell Doug he needs to run more ads. Josh Shapiro's all over TV. When's Doug going to start running the ads? I'll ask him. I mean, one of the things I am going to ask him is, you know, Shapiro's sitting on something like $14, $15 million. And according to reports, Doug doesn't have half a million. Now, I don't know what that means. Does that mean anything? Is Doug sweating that? We'll find out. Doug Mastriano joins us here at the bottom of the hour. Telephone number 610-850-0990. And we're online at 990theanswer.com. Title IX, 50 years of Title IX. If you don't know what it is, let's break it down. Let's discuss it. Let's bring in Angela Morabito, who is the former press secretary for the Department of Education. She's now the spokesperson for the Defense of Freedom Institute. I'd love to discuss it broadly, Angela, and I welcome you in. But more to the point, here's what I do know. When you talk about competitive women's sports, which I know is not all it is, but when you talk specifically about that, I find it hilarious in June of 2022, that we have a progressive politics in this country that's actually cheering the destruction of women's sports, in my view, by allowing biological men to compete. I mean, it's totally counterintuitive to the whole reason for Title IX, in my view. But anyway, I didn't mean to steal any of your thunder. You take it away. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be with you, and you're exactly right on the issue of women's sports. It was 50 years ago yesterday that Title IX was enacted, in no small part to protect women's sports, really to get rid of discrimination on the basis of sex in education. But yesterday, the Biden administration actually proposed a new Title IX rule that would effectively change the definition of sex in the law. They're saying it includes gender identity and sexual orientation. And it was interesting to me what they did on women's sports. They punted, and that pun is absolutely intended. I believe the left knows how extremely unpopular it is to have biological men in women's sports. So what they said yesterday was, hey, we believe Title IX applies to gender identity as well. Schools will have to, if the rule goes forward, treat students in line with their gender identity, not their biological sex. But they said, we're going to make a separate rule about women's sports later down the road. So they're laying the groundwork to effectively end women's sports.
And people like Governor DeSantis, I know, have spoken up early about the Biden administration using funds, I think through the Department of Agriculture, to come at Title IX as well. It sounds like this administration is using lots of executive branches to come at things like Title IX and force states to behave in a certain way, yes?
You're exactly right. Title IX itself, people think of it as this huge, complicated thing. It's actually under 40 words, and it says no discrimination, and I quote, on the basis of sex. The administration would love to pretend that it's on the basis of gender identity, but it does not. Biological sex, fact of the world, gender identity. Somebody could change that on a day-to-day basis. So this is making things really hard for schools. And if a school violates Title IX, violates the Title IX rule that is in force currently, or going, you know, down the road, if this proposed rule actually gets codified into law, any school that violates it would risk losing its federal funding. So this is the left inflicting its gender politics on the next generation and holding their school funding hostage unless the schools themselves play along.
Angela Morabito with the Defense of Freedom Institute. I'm really battling with whether this is a sincere belief held by people in power or if it's just destructive on purpose. Does that make sense? Like, this is not, as a statistical matter, this is not, I don't even know if it's a measurable percentage of the population we're talking about, this kind of heavy-handed administrative action for such a tiny, tiny group of people, but this tiny group of people would be able to wield such destructive power on institutions. I don't know how you view it. It just seems needlessly destructive for a very small segment of the population.
It's strange to me that this administration thinks that a small segment of the population needs different and special treatment when Title IX and the existing Title IX rule from 2020 actually protects all students, no matter who you are, no matter how you identify. You are given the right to due process under that Title IX rule. So it's actually a bigger issue than gender identity. What the administration proposed yesterday would strip away due process protections for students. So if someone is accused of a Title IX violation, they wouldn't have the right to have their representative cross-examine the opposing party in a live hearing. They wouldn't have the right to view the evidence against them. They could view a description of the evidence. But what this does is paves the way for kangaroo courts. It paves the way for chaos. And there is neither gender, or let's humor the left. Let's pretend like there are an infinite number of genders. You could be any gender under the sun, and this Title IX rule would be harmful to you. It also gives survivors less autonomy over their own cases, because if somebody makes a report, the school would be obligated to pursue a case to continue on and file that case in their Title IX process, whether or not that's what the survivor wants. So it is hard for me to see any winner from what was proposed yesterday other than left-wing gender political activists.
I continue to ask, it's almost a redundant and boring question at this point, but where are feminists? Where are left-wing traditional feminists, the Gloria Steinems, the Jane Fondas? Where are they? They can't possibly think this is fair.
Well, it's interesting you say that, and I would disagree with you there. I don't think it's a boring question at all. Back in 2020, I was serving in the Department of Education when Secretary DeVos released her Title IX rule that is currently in force. And the whole left-wing media establishment decided to go and say, oh, it's anti-women, it's anti-this, it's anti-that. It actually expanded protections for survivors. It actually was tremendous progress in ensuring that if someone makes a Title IX complaint, that their case is handled in a way that is fair and timely and protective of survivors, essentially, without denying anyone due process. There were, at that time, quite a few feminist groups who piped up and said, wait a second, this is actually pretty great. Well, I would love to know, as you've asked, where are they now for women's sports? Where are they now that for decades and decades, all these people who said they supported women now refuse to define what a woman is? I don't think you have to be a biologist or an attorney to know what a woman is. So these groups are, so I think some of them are playing go along to get along, and they are putting up with the left's political whims of the day in order for them to get their woke points, for them to get their pats on the head, for them to survive politically. But it's ultimately harmful, not just to the world at large, but particularly to students in the next generation.
Well, it's so well said. Angela Morabito, formerly with the Department of Education, now with the Defense of Freedom Institute. I imagine that these issues wind up before the Supreme Court eventually. I don't know that any of this trans stuff has been before the court yet. It's got to head there, I would guess, or it will.
I would imagine that this is only the beginning of the road for the Title IX rule. We know what the Biden administration's wish list is. That is their proposal that was released yesterday on the 50th anniversary of Title IX. But the administration is assuming that the executive branch has the right to graft a new and different meaning onto a law that has stood for half a century. Not an attorney, don't know how it's legal. And the 2020 Title IX rule was challenged many, many times by the left, but it withstood every legal challenge that was thrown at it. If this rule were to get codified into law, this new proposal, I don't think it would have the same fate. I think that any court in its right mind would look at this and say, this is an executive agency's attempt to legislate their preferred political ideology into existence without ever even consulting Congress. It's pretty wild, and in my view, it's an abuse of power what they're aiming to do.
They are using executive agencies on every front to push everything they want. This is no different. It's a different subject, of course, but it's really no different than using the Department of Labor to insist everybody take a shot to keep their job. It's the same thing, just a different subject, is the way I see it.
I think you're right. These are mandates that are ultimately hurtful. And when you talk about, okay, gender identity-based harassment, that includes, in the left's view, the use of pronouns that someone doesn't prefer. So we've got to defund the pronoun police here. The Biden administration wants to empower these people and say, all right, instead of, I don't know, what they called in Florida was don't say gay. Now they're saying you must say they. You must say all of these different things that people prefer that can change every single day. So you go to school to learn reading, writing, arithmetic. You don't go to school to learn how to use pronouns that people like. I'm sorry if that sounds a bit inelegant, but also forcing someone to use pronouns that they don't want to use, that's compelled speech. If you're forcing me to call a he, a she, or a they, or a these, or whatever's out there, you're compelling my speech to do that.
Well, teachers are starting to fight this in court, and they're winning in some lower courts, actually, on this front, which is encouraging. I like that. We've gone from don't say gay to you must say they. I'm going to keep that, Angela Morabito. Well done. From the Defense of Freedom Institute. Thank you for your visit today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Boss it.
Much like the ladies at The View who could have easily written this, in fact, they may well have written this at The Inquirer, this isn't Biden's fault. None of this is poor Biden's fault. You leave Grandpa alone. I mean, yesterday the ladies had Pepe Le Pew on their show, and as Rush used to call her, Maud Behar, says to Pepe Le Pew, you know, I wish they'd just lay off your boss. He's good people. None of this is his fault. And, of course, Pepe Le Pew jumps right in. Thank you, Joy. You're right. This makes my job easy when you say things like that.
With the president's handling of inflation and the economy hitting lows in recent polls, how do you make the case to voters that his economic policies are working, that it's not his fault, that inflation is a worldwide problem, that the gas prices are not Joe Biden's fault? How do you do that?
Well, you just said it, Joy, which is what we're seeing with gas prices, what we're seeing with inflation.
That's enough. I don't need to hear it. I mean, what a stupid. How do you make the people who consistently say they don't like the job he's doing understand that they're stupid? You understand? That's what Joy Behar just said to the White House press secretary, to which she responds, "You're right, Joy. They are stupid." It's the most remarkable thing I have ever seen in my life. These polls. What do you make of all these people that are so stupid blaming Joe Biden, who's just trying to do the right thing and he's doing great and his economic policies are helping? What do you say to all these people that don't believe it? These idiots. You're so right, Joy. They are morons. He's the best, right? You're damn right he is. Yeah. Say the millionaires. Similarly, over at The Inquirer, not Biden's fault. None of this is Biden's fault. Don't blame Biden for high gas prices, says The Inquirer's editorial board yesterday. No kidding. Don't blame Biden for higher gas prices. Presidents have little control over gas prices, but that hasn't stopped angry motorists from blaming Joe Biden. You stupid, angry motorists, you. Isn't this amazing? The Inquirer editorial board, The View, Joy Behar, they're all just shouting at you. You idiots. How dare you hold Joe Biden responsible for this stuff? Angry motorists out there unreasonably holding this president responsible. Morons, you. Current pump prices are due largely to basic economics of supply and demand. Don't you know? This is literally what they write. Much of the global economy shut down during the pandemic and oil prices plummeted as demand evaporated virtually overnight. In April 2020, the price of a barrel of oil dropped below zero for the first time ever. A gallon of gasoline dropped below $2 a gallon. As demand dried up, oil companies cut back on production and exploration. But then the economy bounced back, and demand for oil increased. But production has not been able to keep pace. With demand far outstripping supply, prices have skyrocketed. Why is demand far outpacing supply? Do they analyze that? Answer, no. They just pivot to always what the same old thing is, Russia, 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 Russia's senseless, brutal, and unprovoked war in Ukraine. Why did they do that? Inquirer editorial board. They didn't, Russia didn't move on Ukraine when Grandpa wasn't in office. Why did they decide to do it when he got there? Probably because they understand that he can't do anything without reading it on a note card. You sit down in your chair. You introduce, you, so embarrassing. The weak husk invited global aggression. A ban on Russian oil imports by the United States and the EU further reduced supply in the global markets. Biden has in part blamed high prices on Russia. He's largely right. Can you believe that they would write this in Pennsylvania? This is a newspaper based in a state with more natural resources and fuel under our feet than Saudi Arabia. But because Russia's not producing fuel, then we're screwed. It's Russia's fault and Russia's war. Prices were rising before the war, but Russia exacerbated the problem. So blaming gas prices on Biden ignores what's really happening. Instead of politicizing oil prices, it's time for lawmakers on both sides to work together to incentivize more green energy solutions, tax credits for wind and solar. Voters wanting to cast blame might want to turn their attention to Joe Manchin of West Virginia and the Republicans in the House and Senate who opposed efforts to boost green energy. The high gas prices aren't Joe Biden's fault. Wow. This is literally written by a child. It has to be. These high gas prices aren't Joe Biden's fault. Blame Joe Manchin, one senator from West Virginia. I wonder if Doug Mastriano, who wants to be the next governor of Pennsylvania, shares the point of view that we ought to leave poor Joe alone. None of this is his fault. Senator Mastriano, welcome in.
Good morning. Typical Democrat play. Never take responsibility. I remember Barack Obama was blaming W for 8 years for catastrophes. You know, in the Army, you were given grace for about 100 days when you took over a new unit, and after that, you owned it. So, Joe, you own this. I know when you came in office, Mr. President, that gas prices were just about $2. So this is on your watch, man.
I don't know how as I just said, in Pennsylvania, of all places, you can write an editorial about energy and gas prices and supply and not talk about what's right underneath us, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we're on a gold mine. And, you know, most people in the nation don't realize that Pennsylvania is the third greatest energy producer in the nation, number three overall. And we have the means and the ability underneath our feet here to just unleash so much prosperity in our state and help our nation as well to be energy independent. And DEP and Tom Wolf for 8 years, you know, together with Lockdown Josh, you know, they did nothing to help our industry. They did nothing to help our elderly. I mean, so when you had the means of production, and instead of opening up the wells and drilling and pushing real hard and making it, you know, friendly for this industry, energy sector, to develop these resources, they're telling about developing green. And that's not available in the levels and the amounts for years. Even if we just dropped everything, it's going to take years to develop. And meanwhile, the people of our state here are struggling with putting gas in the tank or buying food. I mean, this is very, very serious.
Doug Mastriano is the Republican running for governor in Pennsylvania. He faces Josh Shapiro, the Democrat, this fall. Latest poll, one issued by AARP. I don't know if you put any credibility behind it, but it kind of jives with another one, I think. I'm trying to remember which one that we read last week. But they both basically have you within striking distance, within the margin of error. Both of these polls do. Now, I'm going to ask you an uncomfortable question, Doug Mastriano. And you may not care to comment on it. I understand why. It's notable to me that the polls that are released show that you and Shapiro are like neck and neck, statistically tied, while Dr. Oz running as a Republican versus John Fetterman seems to be trailing anywhere, depending on the polls, 6 to 9 points. And I have read some people say that you guys may not really be necessarily on the same page politically, but the two of you together on the same ballot will be helpful with groups that may not look at you otherwise. Is there any merit to any of that? What's going on in that dynamic? And you won by a big margin, whereas there was this razor, you know, this razor thin fight for the Senate. So there's a weird dynamic going on there, Doug. Can you explain it all?
You know, really, I've been thinking through it as well, as you just kind of, you know, went through it real quick. You know, in one regard, obviously, you know, Oz came in a very, very close race. So we could understand it'd be a bigger, you know, delta, a bigger gap between him and Fetterman. For me, I won by a huge margin, and I was outspent 16-1, and one of the candidates spent millions upon millions of dollars of hammering me. So I have two things in my watch. Is first off, you know, I have to rebuild my war chest. I have to raise money since we spent just about everything in the primary, which you want to do. You don't want to, you know, sit on some money and then, you know, lose by 10 votes. Like, we should have gone ahead and done another ad. And then the second thing here is obviously is getting the party back together. So, because we had people split among 9 different candidates, and that's going to take a bit of time. On the Shapiro side, I mean, he's got every advantage. He had no opponent. He's got lots of money. He's, you know, a lot of public sector union money coming in, and the lawyers are pouring money in as well on his side from the Bar Association. As far as Oz, I mean, you know, he's the people's choice, just as I am for governor, and we're going to work together as best we can. And I agree with you; we do each bring something unique to the table that might help broaden our appeal.
Do you? Yeah, I was just analysis I read. That's not mine. I thought it an interesting thing because there's no point in rehashing this. I don't really mean to. In fact, I won't ask it again, and that's my pledge. I'll ask it this last time, and that is: do you feel that the two of you speak to different Republican constituencies or potential voters?
Yeah, I think because of, you know, his popularity and being a public figure for, you know, many decades, that he reaches a different segment of society than necessarily I do. So I do think and postulate that perhaps when you see us on a campaign trail together, that there'll be, you know, my segment of the population, the small business owners, you know, the people that struggled against the lockdown, just average everyday folks, bikers, and even Amish, they might view me differently, and as opposed to his constituents, and it might be beneficial. You know, I did read that analysis as well, and, you know, I thought they brought up some very good points.
They're entirely different races. I mean, we're talking about a Senate race, you know, to go to Congress versus you governing a state. So typically these races are run separately on different tracks. Is there any cross-pollination, do you think, or not really? You guys will run separate races and not have much to do with one another.
Yeah, and you're right. There are, you know, I'll be an executive of a state and we'll have a, you know, U.S. senator, but there is a lot of bleed over. I mean, obviously, I get a lot of say on what goes on in Pennsylvania as far as our energy sector, which you started off the segment with. And the feds have a bit to say in that as well. And so you'll see bleed over on many of the same issues, energy, you know, energy production, and obviously natural gas and coal on our side here, and Oz can be helpful in loosening up the EPA regulations or rolling back some of those, assuming we get, of course, a majority in the Senate here in a few months.
Let's talk about this, in my opinion, gut punch, 15 Senate Republicans, including Pat Toomey, Senator from Pennsylvania, vote on what appear to be red flag laws, certain limits on 18 to 21-year-old gun purchases. I don't know what comes of it, but we know at the same time a 6-3 ruling on affirming your Second Amendment rights came authored by Clarence Thomas yesterday. So yesterday was a very mixed day out of Washington, the Supreme Court standing tall for the Second Amendment. Some Republicans and a Democrat majority in the Senate, in my view, attacking the Second Amendment. So how do you read that as potentially the next governor of Pennsylvania and your role in that discussion?
And a governor can have a lot to say with that, especially if there's a Republican majority, of course, in the General Assembly. And in that regard, I do have a bill, which would be very nice to sign in law, that would prohibit our state law enforcement officials from enforcing what I would view as unconstitutional edicts or commands out of Washington, D.C. And that would include these red flag laws, which takes away, you know, your ability to actually defend yourself instead of having someone just show up at your house and take your weapons, like a neighbor, you know, said you spoke meanly to them. On this regard here, but the very heartening what came out of the Supreme Court, of course, is that they reaffirmed our right to keep and bear arms. So what's going to happen with legislation, of course, that the Senate and the House will pass, is it's going to go into place, sadly, and then there's going to be a huge court fight over it, and they'll go before the Supreme Court, and I think in a few years we'll see a similar ruling striking down this latest legislation to roll back our right to keep and bear arms.
Doug Mastriano is with us, Republican senator here in Pennsylvania. He is running to be the next governor of the Commonwealth. I've had people reach out, Doug, that I'm not going to lie to you. They're a little worried. They're concerned. They see the money totals as reported. You mentioned it. Shapiro's sitting on a mountain of cash. I've read something like 14, 15 mil. The public reporting was that you had about a half a mil. Comparatively, people are seeing a lot of ads, television ads, being purchased, even on Fox News here locally in the Philadelphia market. And people are saying, what's Doug going to do? How's he going to get out of this money hole? It's a blitzkrieg from Shapiro, and we haven't seen hide nor hair of Doug yet in public. Is that fair? Can you overcome that? And how so, if so?
Yeah, I mean, it's up to the people. So all those, you know, political experts out there that want to critique and criticize, now it's time you give. If you care about your state, if you want to help me close that gap with Josh Shapiro, we got a long way to go because we came out of a tough primary, then pitch in. If you're not going to help out and you're a Republican, then just don't even comment on it because you're part of the problem. Josh Shapiro hadn't had to spend a cent. He did not need to spend a cent the past year. But now he spent a little bit of money during the primary. But he had that luxury where he had no opponent. You know, we had a huge field, 9 people, most contentious race in 44 years for the Republicans. Last time they didn't endorse. And so if you want to have a Republican as governor, it's not going to happen magically. You're going to have to give some money. So go to DougForGov.com and pitch in or volunteer. Do something instead of just wringing your hands and critiquing something.
Do you have intention of fighting here in the Southeast, or is your play to go after a lot of the less populated portions of the Commonwealth?
My play is actually to hit the whole state. So the plan is this summer hit all 67, and obviously we're going to surge in areas like in the Southeast that I need a good turnout. And as you pointed out the last time I was on the show, you know, I won all the Southeast except the home county of McSwain and White. You know, they won Chester, respectively, and Delco. I won Philadelphia County in the Republican primary, just to be clear. And so we do have a lot of support there. I do need the suburbs in particular, you know, around Philly. And so I'll be fighting hard for that. And I'm expecting a good turnout because, you know, what does lockdown Josh have to run on? He was a tool of the Wolf administration. He did nothing except go after nuns when your businesses are being shut down. You just can't make this stuff up here. He even did a lawsuit to keep your kids in masks in schools. I mean, the guys... You think Wolf is bad, this guy's going to be 2 times worse.
Do you anticipate debates with this guy? And if so, how do you think you're going to fare? I know you're not literally intimidated by the guy. I don't know if you've met him. I don't know how often you've shared a stage or a venue, but he's skilled. I think you're skilled. Do you anticipate debates with him, and how do you anticipate they'll go, if so?
Yeah, I anticipate 2 or 3 this fall. I mean, the soonest you might see something is September, but definitely in October. And here's the deal, though. I'm going to have terms. I don't want to be on a stage debating both the moderator, like Trump had to do with CNN, and also debating Shapiro. That's not going to happen. So, you know, if I get an invite from some of these radical left-wing places, like the Inquirer, which is all but endorsed memberships at the altar of Josh Shapiro, that's not going to happen. It's got to be a fair platform where we have a moderate moderator there that's going to ask equally hard questions and not take a side.
I'll just say it because there's no reason to beat around the bush about it. We had Selena Zito on a couple of weeks ago, and Selena's not a fan. She seems very irritated that she doesn't have access to your campaign. I've always liked Selena. I thought she did great reporting during the Trump era, but she seems to have some sort of personal axe to grind with you, and as do numbers of people in the media in Pennsylvania. They are complaining that you're not open and accessible and welcoming and letting them in, and as such, you're running an insular campaign that caters to just a select few, and you're not going to be able to grow and reach the base without them, is sort of the attitude, I think. So do you care to respond to that?
Yeah, I never met her. I don't know what her problem is. I don't know if the campaign, you know, was using her. She wrote some very ridiculous inflammatory things that were really, I think, beneath her. She just needs to reach out instead of complaining and, you know, and let the chips fall where they may. You know, I'm not looking for adoration pieces. You know, only Josh gets those from the Inquirer. They got that one reporter that, like, obviously is in love with the guy, has a bromance with him. But if you're going to be reasonably fair, I'll talk to you. But if you're going to go out there, as she did during the primary, and just write ridiculous nonsense, you're very, very disappointed. I heard from many people across the state that they don't know what went wrong there, but something's definitely off. Then I can't help her.
Yeah, I don't mean to give her voice. She can do this for herself. But I've heard this, and so I would love to hear you answer it, because I hear it lobbed at you every now and again, that you speak to just an insulated group of people who only want to talk about election 2020 and nothing else. And if you don't expand your base and grow and have a message beyond election 2020, you can't win. That's a charge I hear leveled at you from time to time. So how do you speak to that?
I would say that's a straw man argument. And she and the others that were part of the establishment argument, I'm not calling her establishment, but part of their argument there, said that I could get more than 20-some% of the vote. I won with 44% of the vote. I won 55 of 67 counties. So the proof is in the pudding. You know, overwhelmingly, you know, in historical context here, going back to 1978, the last time the party did not endorse, it was Dick Thornburg and six other people. So seven people on the ticket. I had nine. Dick Thornburg won with only 33% of the vote. And there was, I don't remember any of this hand-wringing or crying. And he went on to be a good two-term governor. Tom Ridge in 1994 was in a nine-man race, I believe, and he won with only 35% of the vote. And so now jump forward to 2022, and in a nine-man race, very contentious, I won with 44% of the vote. And that's a mandate, and 99% of the Republicans are on board with this here. You know, even spoke with, I've been making a lot of calls, as you can imagine, and even those who worked really hard for other candidates are completely on board. They solved this that in historic context is just outstanding. And so I think that most of the party is on board. And so now it's to reach out to the Democrats and the moderate Democrats and to win over the independents. And we did see that poll from AARP that has me with an 18-point advantage with the independents. And we're going to see that grow, because that's thanks to Wolf and Biden's failed policies, which Josh Shapiro would be an echo of here. It's one thing watching all those ads surging the market, you know, in Philadelphia and on Fox News, whatever. He's got a lot of money, so he can throw things around. But that, I believe that influence and impact goes away when people go to the gas pump and have to decide, you know, how much gas can they afford to put in the tank or how much food they can get this week. And that's the broad reality of life right now in modern-day Pennsylvania.
Listen, I have major concerns about election integrity in Pennsylvania, and I still do. I mean, and obviously this Senate fight, this primary fight that we just lived through that McCormick tried to exploit, and I don't say it negatively. I say it was a literal loophole that he was trying to take advantage of, and that's this, you know, dated ballot business. I mean, we have a lot of unfinished business that the courts may come into play here again when counting votes this fall. So election integrity in Pennsylvania really worries me. Having said all that, some people believe, and I'm asking your opinion, I'm not gunning for one side or the other here. Some believe, listen, election integrity is a worry, but you got to talk about bigger things. You got to move on. You got to think forward. You got to talk about the economy. You got to talk about stuff we're staring down the barrel of now. Election was yesterday. You know, we got to talk about tomorrow. What do you say to that?
So, you know, obviously I travel the state, plus I'm looking at that recent Rasmussen poll, polling, and it's kind of interesting. Our messaging is on target, because according to what I hear from the people as well, even Rasmussen, number one is obviously inflation. Number two is violent crime. Number three, election integrity. Number four is gas prices. But on the other side, the media and, you know, the political insiders want to talk about January 6th and things that have nothing, and Russia and Ukraine, things that people really aren't paying attention to because life is so hard right now in Pennsylvania. And so, number one, you know, like Jim Carville said, who worked for Clinton back in the 90s, you know, it's the economy, stupid, and it really is. I'm old enough to remember the Jimmy Carter years when Reagan came in 1980, and this economy is worse than the Jimmy Carter years, and we have a worse of a gas crisis than what happened in, 73 when the Arabs nationalized their gas, and we had a gas shortage crisis, a real one, in America. And so those things obviously will resound with the people. That's the things they're talking about, the kitchen table.
Have you assessed, Doug, I know no most candidates don't like talking about this, but when you think about or talk about your negatives or your vulnerabilities or where do you think work needs to be done? Obviously, we know what they're trying to frame you as. You're the January 6th guy, and all they want to do is hang insurrection around your neck. I think if people are inclined to believe that about you, I don't know that there's any talking people out of it. But outside of that, I don't know what Josh Shapiro has to offer. And I'm serious. That's not just me being partisan. You've pointed it out. What does he run on except you're the insurrectionist?
Yeah, and that's just the problem. So, and then when you go to my pages, you'll see, you know, what I'm focusing on here, real legislation. I'm trying to lock down on crime and trying to help people during a fentanyl crisis. We got 4,500 deaths last year, I believe. You know, record number of murders, of course, in Philadelphia, which you talked about. You know, you've addressed often on your show. And then, of course, living life, you know, going to the store and seeing empty shelves, no baby formula, and inflation through the roof, record setting. And what does Josh talk about? I mean, he's got a big problem. So he was the attorney general for 7 years during the Wolf administration. And what did Josh do to help the people of the state? You know, suing nuns. What did he do when the lockdowns happened and small businesses were shut down? He's completely in the pocket of his party. He's a loyal son of the Democrat Party and doesn't care anything for the people of the state. And I say that just because I'm not prone to hyperbole. I'm a retired Army colonel. But I don't see anywhere that he's done anything. You know, as a senior law enforcement official of the state, has things gotten better under Josh Shapiro? They've gotten worse under him. And if you think things are bad now, wait till, you know, because one thing, yes, Wolf was deemed by Forbes as the most liberal governor in the nation back a couple of years ago. I agree. Probably so. He's got some stiff competition. But Josh Shapiro is more of an ideologue than Tom Wolf, just by his behavior for the past 7 years. And so he has nothing to run on. You know, as far as the January 6th narrative, he's got now this is the thing, and Selena needs to pay attention. He's the guy that's talking to his very narrow base. He's not talking to the state. He wasn't there during the shutdown. He didn't lift a finger to help anyone in the state. And all he's doing is using the Democrat talking points, which I'm glad for. He's going to fall flat on his face. But Rasmussen, look at that in that same poll that I cited just a few minutes ago. People just don't even care about this thing going on in Washington, D.C. It does not affect them. The Democrats have gone too far, as they always do on these issues.
Abortion scare you? If this Roe versus Wade thing comes down here in the next week, as we think it's going to, and abortion gets handed back to the states, there's a conventional wisdom out there that this is really going to drive a lot of suburban people, particularly women, to the Democrat side without them even having to lift a finger. Do you believe that?
I really don't, because, you know, it's one thing when you're in a 1990s economy under Clinton, where he actually, when he took a trouncing in 96 and adjusted, you know, he became more moderate. That's the fact. He worked with Newt Gingrich, even did a reform of welfare. But we're in an environment where Wolf / Shapiro are so far left that they can't adjust their thinking. So, and likewise, the Biden administration is being led, you know, obviously by radical leftists. And so the economy is going to be strangling people, making it very difficult to live. You got to choose between medicine, food, and fuel, or cooling your house, or heating your house in a few months. And these peripheral issues, such as abortion, all this won't resound. I know that's where he's putting his two things on, of course, on January 6th and abortion. And here's the reality. You know, my personal view of abortion really, in some regards, is irrelevant, because I can't do anything on an issue unless the General Assembly moves legislation to address it. And so I do believe the Supreme Court will hand the powers back to the state, where even Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that it should have belonged there in the first place. You know, she was very pro-abortion, and that she called this one right. So I look forward to signing into law the heartbeat bill, you know, using scientific modern approaches here on determining when there's life. And, of course, the logic and the thinking on the heartbeat bill is when you hear a heartbeat, you hear a life. When somebody no longer has a heartbeat, you know, they flatline, they're declared dead. Therefore, logically, if you hear a heartbeat, you hear a life. And the benefit always seems to be with life. You know, I do believe that all babies deserve a right to life. And I look forward to working with the legislative body here to sign things into law. Another thing, of course, is the Down Syndrome Protection Act. 60-some% of Down's babies in America are aborted. And this will protect their darling little lives as well, not just sending them to death because of a diagnosis sometime, which is wrong for a doctor.
Doug Mastriano, you said the last time we talked, you know, I said, you know, people that are sore about the election of 2020, or they have hurt feelings, or they're ticked off, or things didn't go the way they hoped, or they don't trust the system. They just, screw it, we're not going to vote. You had no time for that. You were very clear. But having said all that, do you feel you have an infrastructure in place, or you're aware, having been such a student of 2020 and the way it went down in Pennsylvania, specifically Philadelphia, do you think you have an apparatus in place, a structure in place to get ahead of any kind of election chicanery on behalf of Shapiro by Democrats, particularly in Philly? Do you know what to anticipate is my question.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. So for the primary, I did. For the general, we're still working on it. We got a long ways to go. And obviously, we're looking at different examples of what happened in the various elections here in Pennsylvania, not just 2020, but also the previous several elections, where we had the referendum, of course, last year, and of course this year as well. And also looked at Virginia and Youngkin's race there. And although there are many differences or some similarities with the problems they had with elections, and what the Republicans did in Virginia, I mean, there's several things. I'll just address the facts that are relevant to this question. Is number one, the Republicans did not sit and bring their hands and say, well, I'm not sure my vote counts, so I'm just going to sit, you know, at home and complain. They got out and voted in overwhelming numbers, and that helped overcome the deficit that, of course, is in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., like Fairfax County and what have you. Number two, the Republicans just didn't sit around and complain, you know, wondering if their vote counted. They manned 95% of the polling stations, had Republicans in the rooms watching for accountability and transparency. So that means that translates in Pennsylvania. If you care about your state and you want to hand over Pennsylvania with the same freedoms to your kids that you enjoyed, then you have to get out and vote. That's number one. That's the least you can do as an American. Number two, I need 7,000 plus volunteers to man all the polling stations across the state, and I need a lot of people to sign up. So go to DougForGov.com and do your bit. We really need you. This is one of the most important elections in history. I say that as a historian in Pennsylvania. I can't think of a more different path. You have the path of course, oppression and loss of freedoms and government regulations and government oversight on the side of Josh Shapiro, continuation of Tom Wolf's heavy-handed policies. And then on my side is reduce the size of government, roll back taxation wherever we can, and unleash the potential of our energy sector. You're bringing prosperity and potential back to our state.
DougForGov.com. Doug, come back and talk with us anytime you'd like. We appreciate your time today, sir. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Chris. God bless you.
That's Doug Mastriano. Going to wrap it up here today. That'll do it for us. We'll see you Monday on Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer.
This is WNTP, Philadelphia's AM 990, The Answer. A Salem Media Group station on the NASDAQ at SALM. 3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.